Global fisheries, are the gloom and doom justified? That is the topic of a speech by Dr. Daniel Pauly given at the University of British Columbia on March 10, 2007, as part of the top-rated Vancouver Institute series of lectures. This is the question and answer period, about 22 minutes long, and Dr. Pauly addresses some major worries about the future of the oceans. You can download the original speech as a separate MP3 file from www.ecoshock.org in the Oceans section.
As usual, we have time for questions now, and if you'll state them, I'll repeat them over the microphones. The audience can hear them, and Dr. Pauly will answer them. Can we feed farm salmon and agricultural products rather than ground-up fish?
I got yesterday a long email from a person from the industry who was telling me we can produce fish without any input from other fish. The question is, why don't they? Because the input is too cheap. It's so cheap that the fish meal is so cheap that they can get away with it. But I don't believe it. Actually, if they produce without fish meal, using soy meal, for example, the thing would taste like tofu. It would have no taste. You can see that when you eat catfish, in American, the U.S. catfish, there is a huge industry, catfish industry in the South, in Arkansas and so on, and they produce this catfish using vegetable soybean, essentially. They have no taste whatsoever. So technically they could produce this salmon, but actually, though they say it's a price question because the fish meal is very cheap, it's actually not true, it's a question of taste.
Other questions?
It's hard to measure the amount of fish in the ocean that how accurate do you think your numbers are? Would they be outside 10%, 20%? But, you know, I mean, if I go and catch a fish and it's this long, I might tell people it's that big. And so the same thing applies when you're dealing with trying to estimate the number of fish that are in the world.
Yeah.
Trying to estimate what is caught is very difficult.
Yeah.
How accurate are the estimates of the amount of fish in the ocean?
Actually, the precision of estimates in the sea is much worse than the figure you give of 20-30%. It might be 50%. You're quite happy when you get a 50% precision. But actually, I was not talking about absolute amount. The important thing is the change. The change can be measured more accurately. If you have a change, for example, in a thing called catch per effort, if you can correct that change and have a measure of effort of what you do to catch the fish that is very similar, and you compare two periods, and you can set that one as 100% without knowing how much it is, and express the other one as a percentage of what is left, and you would have 20% left or 10% left, and that can be fairly accurate. I would think within 20 or 30%. So, but the absolute amount, you're right, are very difficult to estimate.
There was a question over here.
Yes. There still seems to be some cod left off of Iceland and Norway. What is the chance of a crash stock like the Canadian
It depends on the species and the situation. Actually, some species recover fairly well. The herring type, anchovy type, recover very well. We have learned in the meantime that things like cod don't recover well, or at least not in the human scale. But the problem with Canada, the recovery, the non-recovery of Canadian cod, is complicated because actually, since the moratorium, they have continued to fish it. When the moratorium was declared, it was because the catch had collapsed and they were not catching anymore because there were so few left in the water. Now, of that in very reduced stock, there was under the moratorium, there was a quota for sport fishes. There was home fish by, essentially, Newfoundlanders could fish for their own supply, and this was not monitored. This was not, this was tolerated. And there was substantial fish that was caught as bycatch of other fisheries, young cod in, for example, the shrimp fishery. And the DFO does not include bycatch computation in the assessment. When it wants to evaluate how much a stock is, how much of a stock there is, it doesn't include what is removed as bycatch, because these are different scientists that do it. And if, I don't know, in a shrimp fishery, they have a cod bycatch, that's a shrimp biologist and not the cod biologist, therefore they will not talk. This sounds silly, but it's happening. So actually, the cod was continuously being fished at, if at low level, through the moratorium, but the stock was very much reduced. Actually, the fishing intensity, the fishing relative to the biomass that was in the water, was very high still after the moratorium. And so it's no wonder that it did not recover.
Bert?
Developed countries of the world have not evidently managed their fisheries very well. We've seen the fractions in Europe as well as in North America. How can the developing countries have any confidence that the direction and the models that are hoisted on them will be successful?
Well, the question.
The aspect of this question, the code of conduct for responsible fishing was designed.
The question was, when the developed world has made such a mess of its fisheries, how can it be confident the underdeveloped world will have any confidence in our measures? And the second question was on assessing this.
It's not the scientists who do model, who do the fishing, actually. And while it certainly happens that scientists have often produced a model that were over... too optimistic. Actually, throughout much of Africa and Asia, the fishery is operated without assessment, without estimates of the biomass, of how much should be caught. And how much is caught really is determined solely by the economics of fishing and by banks, by entrepreneurs who decide to fish or not to fish. And they have such power that they can overrule anything that the Department of Fisheries would come up with. And therefore, I don't spend my time anymore blaming the scientists for the models that they transfer from Europe, say, to Africa. Because what happens in Africa, the fishing, is not determined by scientists whatsoever. It's determined solely by access agreement and by bribery and the economics of fishing of European vessels in Africa, for example, not at all by assessment, because these things are really irrelevant. That's one. And the second part, the code of conduct was proposed in 1995, a code of conduct for how fisheries should be regulated and how they should behave. It's a voluntary code of conduct, and it's full of good things, and it has been evaluated by my colleagues, Tony Pitcher and his students. And essentially, he finds that the countries that manage the fisheries halfway right also score well on the code of conduct. And the countries that don't manage the fisheries right anyway, they score badly on the code of conduct. In other words, a code of conduct, what you do with it, reflect what you're going to do anyway. I don't think that it had any influence on its own.
A question here, and then in the front row.
Should the trawl fishery be banned? What kind of fish would replace it if it is banned? And where is the government
Canada? Should the trawl fishery be banned, and with what would it be replaced?
I think that trawling will actually eventually be banned and recognized as the destructive gear that it is. This will be made easy by the economics of trawling. Trawling is extremely energy intensive. And we can show, for example, Rashid and has recently, with Shumala here, has recently shown that deep sea fisheries are so dependent on subsidies that because they use so much energy, that if they didn't get it, they would not be profitable. So that's one thing. The other thing is that more and more areas without trawling are being declared, are being closed to trawling, much more than marine protected areas. Marine protected areas is areas where no fishing whatsoever is allowed in principle. And such things don't grow fast, I've shown you that. But areas without trawling, where no trawling is permitted, are growing very rapidly. And for example, all deep water, I think 1,000 or more than 500 meters or 300 in the Mediterranean is close to trawling. All areas in the Pacific that belong to the USA is close to trawling and so on. So trawling is maybe on its way out. We think historically, within 10, 20 years.
Replaced by?
Most of the fish that we exploit in trawls have a coastal manifestation. For example, cod, at least when they are abundant, occur in depth and in shallow water. You can, if you fish them in shallow water, as I presented at the beginning of my presentation, if you fish them in shallow water only, it's cheaper. You get a good product because you use lines and traps. In other words, it's all mashed up in the net. And the large female that produce all the eggs and all the recruitment are protected by depth. So this is why this fishery in Canada could go so long. And the trawlers destroyed that fishery by going where it, at depth where these large females were. So basically, we can, with gear such as traps and long lines, deep set long lines and so on, we can do the same thing, and gill nets. We can essentially do the same thing as trawlers. Also, you have to realize that with trawlers, we move something against the fish. And in an energy scarce world, you will want to use the energy that the fish have to catch themselves. In other words, they move.
The gentleman in the front row, and then at the very back. And next.
Year after year, it seems that the Department of Fisheries and Oceans has a very difficult time projecting what the fish stocks locally shall be. To what do you attribute their
What is the reason Department of Fisheries and Ocean has such a difficult time assessing local stocks of fish?
I think it's because, to be honest, it's because it's difficult. It is very easy for me to present a global trend. If you look over long term, and if you look over a large area, the trends are evident. But I could not, using the methods that we use, we could not predict the catch next year. We could not predict what the quota should be next year. It is actually very difficult. That should be said beforehand. The scientists at DFO, they are trying to do the best job they can. And this is very difficult. You're thinking of salmon and the other fish stocks. It's very difficult. The point is, the problem is not that they do the assessment wrong. The problem is that they do only such assessment and they don't do strategic thinking. In other words, in fisheries, you have tactical thinking about what are you going to do next year. And there is strategic thinking. How should the fishery look like? And the DFO's strategy has been to concentrate the fishery in a few hands because it's easier on them. It's easier to manage the fishery. And they do that on every coast. To concentrate the fishery on a few hands, give only a few licenses, wipe out the small fisher. Wipe out the small fisher because they don't want to be bothered. That has been consistent DFO policy. But that's the strategy. At the tactical level, the work that FDFO does is very good.
The gentleman at the back?
Yeah, because I would have switched over to doom and gloom.
Ocean acidification was the question.
This ocean acidification problem, you understand what it is. If you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide will go in the water. Presently, a figure you will remember, 1 million ton per hour of carbon dioxide goes from the atmosphere in the water. 1 million ton per hour. It's a nice number. It will be true for the next 10 years, approximately. Then it will be 2 million ton per hour. Anyway, that's how much. And then if you put carbon dioxide in water, what you get is carbonic acid, dilute carbonic acid, right? You can take a Coke, since you don't want to drink that stuff, put a bone in it, and it will be dissolved in a week or so. This is a weak acid, carbonic. So we are acidifying the ocean. That's happening. And I was at AAAS, that is the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a few weeks ago in San Francisco. And essentially, the ocean will cease to harbor life in 100 years. But you don't want to hear that on a Saturday evening. And that will be due to the tar sand in Alberta. There is a very convincing argument was made that all massive extinction on Earth, the five big extinction on the Permian and so on, including the one that hit us in 65 million years ago that ended up the dinosaurs and stuff, was followed by disappearance of a massive part of the oceanic fauna and flora. And the author attributed to not temperature, not the nuclear winter, because of the sunlight not reaching the Earth and so on, because of the dust in the atmosphere and so on, but acidification that followed. For example, after the event 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaur, this was due to a big meteor hitting the Yucatan Peninsula. And those of you who have spent vacation there will know that the soil is caustic. It's calcium carbonate, really old reef. And all of this was sent up in the atmosphere, which was then sulfuric acid rain for probably centuries. And that wiped out lots of marine life. And we will have conditions similar to that in about 100 years. So, yeah, if I talked about that, I shouldn't, because I'm not a chemist and I don't work on that. But I understand what it is. And this is the end of life as we know it. 100 years, so it will be your grandchildren. Don't bother.
We have time for one more question. Gentleman here. Yes.
You just mentioned all kinds of influence from different types of pollution. Would you, in your work, in your research, also consider the oceanic or the marine landscape over North America and noise and impact on the fish?
Yeah. Yeah, obviously we are doing a mess, and we're noisy about it on top of it. And the animals are exposed, marine mammals, for example, are exposed to excessive noise. And this excessive noise destroys their hearing. And there are more and more strandings where the head was cut. It's actually a major job to cut the head of a whale, right? And brought to the lab and examine the inner air, which was destroyed. Well, the U.S. Navy loves, and the oil industry loves to have underwater explosions. And that's a sure thing to render a few marine mammals deaf. Again, 100 years from now, we won't have to care about that.
I think We'll have informal questions out in the lobby. There'll be refreshments out there, but
except that it won't be me who answers them.
But I'd like to call on the Vice President of Research, Professor John Hepburn, to thank our speaker. Appropriate, because this is the culmination of Research Week at UBC.
Tonight's lecture, for those of you who want to know more about research and the many activities going on at UBC. It's the culmination, unfortunately, of Celebrate Research Week. We've had many, many public events, and so if you miss them this year, at exactly this time next year, we'll do the same thing all over again, and so you'll have plenty of opportunity then. But tonight's lecture was the Excellence in Research lecture, and it's a fitting end to Celebrate Research Week. First of all, because the research that we've heard about in very, very compacted form is excellent research, and the number of awards that not just Daniel Pauly, but his colleagues have won, and we celebrated some of them, a major award this year at the Celebrate Research Gala celebration. We also celebrated last year awards that Daniel won, and the year before that, and the year before that. So nobody doubts the excellence of the research. So it's appropriate that excellence in research lecture should be given by scholars of the importance of Daniel Pauly. But I'd like to reflect a little bit on what we mean when we talk about excellent research. Okay, excellent research is not something that's esoteric and that has no meaning other than to other excellent researchers. Excellent research is research that changes the way we think about the world we live in, changes the way we live. And I think that the research that we've heard about tonight, if it doesn't change the way we think, well, we're not thinking. And if it does change the way we think, then it will change the world we live in. And the other problem alluded to right at the end in question period, the problem of global climate change, is also a problem being dealt with by researchers at UBC and researchers around the world. So I think all of us should reflect on, you know, how important this knowledge is and how it can change, how it can have a positive effect. I think Daniel is right. We need to be gloomy, but we're not doomed. With knowledge, we can change things, and I'd like to thank Daniel for telling us about the very important work that he and his colleagues have been doing and giving us all something to think about and to act upon. Thank you, Daniel.
You have been listening to questions and answers from Dr. Daniel Pauly of UBC on March 10, 2007, on the topic Global Fisheries, Are the Gloom and Doom Justified? Our thanks to Dr. Pauly and the Vancouver Institute for allowing this recording, and to audio technician David Gold. You can download the original one-hour speech, free, as a separate file from www.ecoshock.org in the Oceans section.